tam junipers.
Yeah, David put in 200 tam junipers. He went down to Portland, took a big truck, went down and got them, brought them home. Mm-hmm. And then they had to be watered every day. A friend of his had said, you need to water those, hand water those, mm-hmm. every single day for at least 30 days. So I was out watering these junipers, and along came a lady, and I spoke to her. She was a very nicely dressed lady, and she said she was just stopping in town for a few days and walking around in the city. And I said to her, would you like to see the house? Boy, did she. She was delighted to see the house. And I was delighted that she was so delighted. So I showed her the house. And a couple days later, I was out in the yard again, and she came by with all of her family. And I had a problem at that time. And it was due at an appointment, and I couldn't offer to show him the house again. And I always felt badly about it, because I know she came by again because she wanted her family to see this house. Mm-hmm. So you fall down every once in a while and don't do what would have been, could have been late for my appointment, been a little more.
Did you ever get requests from organizations to allow them to do fundraisers that would feature the house?
Well, I tell you, the strangest thing that happened one time, the front doorbell rang, and I went to the door, and there stood this man with all these children. And he said, we've come to see the historical house. And I said, oh. He said, this is a house that's tax-free, isn't it? And I said, oh, no, this is our personal residence. I said, it isn't even on the historical register. I said, this is a perfect personal residence. Oh, he said, I understood that we could come up with, it was like a museum. And I said, no, it isn't. But I said, you come on and see the house and bring the children. And I knew they'd be dreadfully disappointed.
Yes.
And
he was making up this little story.
Well, but he had all these kids with him.
Yes.
And he was from the school, not from, it was the 7 day Adventist school. I think it was genuine, because one thing that happened, they finally posted a little sign in the assessor's office, and it said the property at 1612 Walnut pays a full tax, because we had a new publisher come to town. His name was Anderson.
For the Observer?
For the Observer. First thing he did when he saw that house was go up to the courthouse to see if we paid taxes. Right. And he wasn't the only one. This right. happened time and time again. Right. So much so that they finally had a sign. They didn't. And I had one woman who moved across the street with her five little children, and she sent them over to play in our yard all the time because it was a playground, you know, public. And I didn't mind so much, except she had one little boy that liked to ride the garage door up. It was electric, and he pushed the button to grab the door and ride it to the top. And I couldn't get him to quit. And so I talked to his mother, and she wasn't too interested in having him quit. And so I didn't get any results there. He still rode the garage door up. So I was talking to my neighbor, Della Overman, across the street. And I said, what in the world do you do about this situation? She said, get your 14-year-old boy to go out and give him a good swat on the bottom. But don't you do it, she said. Oh, I tell you, I got a kick out. And it worked. Yeah.
Has there ever been an attempt to have the house placed on the historic register?
Not that I know of.
You think it should be?
Yes, I do. I do, because of the fact that there still isn't another house in town like it. Now, there might be houses out of town, but this is an in-town place. There isn't another house like it. And with it,
I would think we'd certainly qualify.
Yes, I think so too. Yeah. And I don't know whether any of the bed and breakfast people tried to put it on the market.
I don't know either.
Uh-uh.
Now, presently the name Stang is spelled S-T-A-N-G.
Isn't that too bad?
And I understand that it's supposed to be spelled with an E.
That's right. And when Ann Decker heard that they'd done that, she sent her daughter up to talk to them.
Well, who did it?
The McClures.
What? Do you know why they did?
Yes. She said people were mispronouncing the name. They'd call it Stange but I still don't think that's any reason for changing it, even though they mispronounced the name.
I've heard that the Jensens plan to change it back to the original.
Well, I hope they do, because that's what it should be. McClure's lost sight of something there. I had some miscellaneous stuff that I took to the owners of the house as they came along. I took some a bedspread that matched draperies in one of the rooms and gave that back to them. I paid for it. I mean, I had done it myself. It was my decoration. And I also took over some incidental things that had been in the house to see if they'd like to have them. And of course, I've got things for this thing. It's from Stang's. This settee. I've had it recovered, though. And this was from Stang's. That's from Mrs. Stang's. And,
Did the Stang's want you to purchase as much of their belongings as you could?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you must have purchased a considerable number of items.
Oh, yes. I'll tell you, if you'll excuse me again.
Sure.
I'm going to have you go in the music room.
All right.
And look at the...
This is the second interview with Jeanette Baum on April 23rd, 2003. Your heritage on your mother's side, at least, goes quite far back. Tell me about the grand or great-grandparents coming to Oregon.
Yes, about 1943. My great-great-great-grandparents.
That's 1843.
Yes, excuse me.
Yes. A century back.
Yes, oh, I know it, yeah.
Yes, yes.
And it was the Liggett family, and they came out to Oregon.
From where?
From Missouri.
Mm. Uh-huh. Did you have any indication from anybody about what made them want to come here?
They heard about the good life in Oregon, and there was... lots of people that came back that brought wonderful news and
you
glorious.
Think that good life was supposedly best lived in the Willamette Valley?
Well, and not only that, they were all well in the valley, and everybody was sick back in Missouri for some reason.
Uh-huh.
And so they wanted to go out where they could participate in this good life.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was my three greats. My grandparents, and then the two greats, they were Grubb was their name. Benjamin Grubb and his family came out, and my great grandmother was Melissa Grubb, who came with them on that trek, and they arrived safely. And
do you have any details from letters or diaries about that trip?
Well. Did you ever hear of the Meek cutoff?
Yes.
Very, very sad affair.
Mm-hmm.
The Liggetts were on that.
Tell me a little about that.
I wish I could tell you more. I've always wanted to get that book. Have you ever seen the book on that?
I don't believe
there's,
so.
There's a book. And I've got the name of that book in my file. And I thought maybe I'd go down to the library and see if they could... get a copy. I know it's not in print any longer, but many people lost their lives on that cutoff. It was bad advice, but they did survive, and they arrived, and then they wrote gloriously back to those left behind, their daughters and families.
Did you have any record about whether they came through the Grand Ronde Valley on that trip?
Not. not them, but my grandfather came through here. Uh-huh. My mother's father came through here, and he stayed here for a winter, but it was too cold and windy for him, and so he went on over into Umatilla area.
I see. Did he write some letters while he was here?
No, no. He was not.
How do you know about his reaction to the valley?
When he came into the valley, his children, what he had said to his
stories
children.
Stories that he told them.
Uh-huh. And he attended a wedding while he was here in the valley. And one time, Florence was at a meeting.
Florence, your sister?
My sister, Florence Davidson.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the PEO sisters got up and gave a report and read the wedding list, and my grandfather's name was on that wedding list. But we weren't smart enough to inquire more about it and to perhaps get a copy of the guests or something. Afterthought is wonderful. Hindsight, I guess you'd say. But he came out in 62, so it was two decades after the Liggetts came out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Liggetts and he were not related. They came in from my father's side and my grandfather's side and my grandmother's.
Of course, 1862 was just about the time that white settlers came here.
Yes, yes. And he went over into Umatilla, and he apparently obtained some sheep some way. And he started increasing his herd, or his flock, and married my grandmother, who was about 11 years younger than he, and they took up residence in Ukiah, a sheep camp that they established so they could winter their sheep.
Mm-hmm.
And their first baby was born in Ukiah and died of pneumonia 5 months later.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this kind of bothered him because while his next child was born there, or was born over in Umatilla, not in Union, not in Ukiah, he'd moved his camp. And then their next child was born there. But by the time the third child was born, they'd moved to Heppner, and he had acquired a lot of land. He did very well with his sheep, and at that time, wool was very precious, and the buyers would come in, and I've got pictures of the buyers in Heppner coming in for his produce, and he was quite a well-to-do man. He acquired a lot of land, and was able to leave his children of nine each a nice piece of property, and probably money too.
Mm-hmm.
But that was on the Hager side of the family. This Liggett side of the family is a different side. It comes from Liggetts down to Grubbs, down to Holman's, and then the Holman daughter married my grandfather, James Hager. So that's how you connect up. But They all participated in the trek west. Yeah. They wanted to come to Oregon badly. It was supposed to be the promised land.
Did you say that you do or do not have any written records from them?
I have this one letter, copy of a letter that my great-grandmother, my great-grandmother's parents, who were Benjamin Grubb, wrote to the Liggetts here and told them they were not getting along well back there, and they were going to sell everything. Their health was very poor, and they needed a better life.
Do you think they had any sense of how difficult the trip would have been?
I think telling them to come out 300 miles at least to help them was pretty much... They knew how difficult it would be.
Well, explain that a little more now. Who was supposed to come out on the trail?
The first ones out here were the Liggetts,
mm-hmm.
my great-great-great-grandparents.
Uh-huh.
And they received this letter from their daughters, their daughter, who was married to Benjamin Grubb and had a family of children. And she wrote that they would like to come out and join them. And also they would bring all their children, and that they would need some help. So they would have to come out on the trail at least 300 miles to meet them. So that would be
quite... knew that she knew what she was asking?
I don't know, but of course they've done that a lot, you know. Look at the Mormons when they went up into the to save that handcart company. They went, the mileage was, and distance was nothing. They went after them.
The family ties must have been strong.
What?
The family ties must have been strong.
Yes, I think they were.
Overcoming the difficulties of going out to meet someone 300 miles in a wagon with oxen or horses, I suppose.
Oh, I know, and probably supplies like you can't believe.
Oh, yes, yes.
I just would like to have heard about that, but there was never any record of that. What transpired, or if they even did it. But I'm sure they must have. Yeah.
Somehow they got here.
Uh-huh.
The details are sketchy. Is that
yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
As with so many historic
events. Anyway,
yes.
that side of the family, which is my mother's side, were the pioneers. My other side, my father's family, he was a railroader and a very successful man at his business. And he came to Eugene and settled in Eugene, but that was in 1910. And they came out on the train. They didn't come with a wagon group.
You grew up in Hefner, right?
Uh-huh. When I didn't grow up. I just lived there 2.5 years.
Oh, I see.
I was born there, back in the horse and buggy age.
Yes.
And I can remember the horse and buggies coming into Hefner. And my mother would say, oh, now you come on in the house. We got to shut the doors. The horse and buggies are coming by. And they were kicking up a lot of dust. And she wanted the doors and windows shut and us kids inside.
Uh-huh.
Because the dust was terrible, I guess.
Yes.
And so Dad worked in a bank there, and he was a basketball player for the University of Oregon and was captain of the basketball team a couple of years. And kind of their hot shot player, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And just to kind of deviate a little bit here, there was a sports writer that wrote about him. And he said, when sin stays awake, which he did in this, which he finally did wake up in this last game, we won the game, you know. Well, I ran across that little item, and I talked to Dad about it, and made him mad all over again. But anyway, they went to Hefner, where he worked in the bank there. And the man who was coaching the basketball team in Hefner got sick. So Dad coached the basketball team for the Hefner High School, yeah. And he had they had about 2.5, maybe 3 years in Hefner. Then he took a job in Salem with as a bank examiner, and traveled for a year and didn't like that. So we moved to Medford, where he went with the Jackson County Bank.
And then skipping a few years after you had finished high school, perhaps while you were in college, you met a man named David Long.
I did. Uh-huh. I met him at Oregon State.
You married him before either of you had graduated?
No. We waited till after we graduated. Uh-huh. That was the days when there were very few married students on campus. They were kind of not accepted into the life of the college. And I certainly didn't want to do that. I was enjoying college.
Sure.
And the not only my studies and things, but I enjoyed the social life. And,
then he was drafted into military service.
He was. He was in ROTC.
Uh-huh.
And in
he was a good candidate.
43. He was drafted into the army up at Fort Lewis and was gone from the campus for several weeks while he shoveled coal up there.
When he was released from service, the two of you decided to move back to Union County.
Yes.
Because he had lived here.
He was born in the Grand.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And he just considered this his valley. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to come back to to the Grand.
But at that time, housing was rather difficult to find, I suspect.
Mm-hmm. It was.
So
at
where
that
did
time,
you,
it was very tight then.
Where did you find a place to live?
Well, we finally, after living with his parents until we couldn't find a place, we rented a little duplex from Delisle Green down on Main Street.
Well, tell me a little about the part of living out toward Union. When you first came to back to Union, or when coming back to Union County was back for David, but first time for you. I mean, you hadn't
right.
been in Union County before.
Just to visit.
Just to visit.
Uh-huh.
I see.
Just to visit.
So you had to live for a while at
with his
a
parents.
Ranch
uh-huh.
in Union?
Uh-huh. Yes, his parents owned a farm over on Catherine Creek, and the road was later named Miller Lane. Because of the Miller family that had lived there for over a century. And so we were there with them for about 6 months while we tried to get located in a job and a house.
What was the nature of their farm?
It was wheat and alfalfa, and then she raised Cocker Spaniels, and they also had, did I say sheep?
No.
They also had some sheep.
Uh-huh.
It was just kind of a general thing. They had chickens and things. Lots of vegetables in the garden.
Mm-hmm.
It was summertime, and she had a huge raspberry patch, and it was still a family that came through the Depression, and they made everything count. Raised rabbits and for their pelts and for their meat.
Hard workers then.
Yes, they were very much so.
Did you have any time, or did you have opportunities to get into the town of Union?
No, at that time, it seems to me like they had a lot of family there, and we socialized a lot with the family, and the Baxters and the Hutchisons and their families. And I didn't make any inroads of. I just don't know why I didn't get involved in the town. I think I was too busy trying to get my own life settled and going.
My understanding is, though, that Union at that time, the town itself, was fairly thriving place. The flour mill and various other kinds of businesses. And
yes.
I think two schools that were operating simultaneously.
A dairy.
A dairy, yes.
Uh-huh. And then there were big sawmills over there, mm-hmm. too. And it was a place that was a very interesting place because of all the old homes, the lovely old Victorian homes and Queen Anne homes, and then a home with those mansard-styled roofs would fascinate one.
Yes, and this, of course, was pre-freeway, so there was a fair amount of traffic, I suppose, through Union.
Yes.
It was Highway 30.
Correct.
Were you aware of that?
Yes, very much so. But it didn't bother me because we were out on the
right,
farm.
Right.
And then too, life was still pretty slow moving. See, there was no superhighway coming through.
Yeah.
As you said.
Lots of automobiles though.
Well, there was a very tight reproduction on the automobile system at that time. And
what do you mean by that?
they weren't producing automobiles at the rate that they were wanting. Wanting them.
Right.
And David and I had we'd saved up enough money during the time that we weren't together, and he was overseas, that we had enough money to buy an automobile. But the trick was that there were so many ahead of you that you couldn't get an automobile.
Long waiting list.
But Irvin Hess, who owned the Chevrolet garage in Union, Oregon, told David that he would get the next car. He was giving these cars to the vets that had come back from World War II. And so we got a car.
Was that your first car?
Mm-hmm, very first car. Chevrolet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can still see it. It was a maroon car and quite boxy looking.
Did you learn to drive it right away?
I had already learned when I was very young. I learned to drive when I was 14. And so I didn't have to do that. I automatically knew.
Did you take it into Union to do any shopping?
I don't recall shopping. For one thing, we used what we had, and we were still recovering from the Depression. So was their family.
Right.
And then they had children they were trying to educate still. And David's younger brothers, too, Frank and Bob, were still in need of a college education.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't buy anything frivolous, believe me. And of course, reared in the Depression as I was, you were lucky if you had one pair of shoes.
Mm-hmm.
And my family experienced that just like every other family
sure.
did. And it's nice now to live in the era in which we do, where you don't have to count every penny.
Yeah.
Yes.
Sure.
Yes. Now, back then, I can remember a penny would buy 10 pieces of candy. You did. You watched your pennies.
Right. So you found a place to live in LeGrand.
Yes, we did.
Why did LeGrand seem like a more desirable place to live?
Because of its size and because of the fact that I think David, in the back of his mind, planned on going into business in something here in LeGrand, taking up something. And
he wasn't working while you were living in the Union?
Yes, he took a job with Sigma Nu Fraternity and was their Western representative and traveled. And I traveled with him a lot. We didn't have children at that time.
Uh-huh.
And we traveled the Western states visiting the Sigma Nu chapters. It was fun. I got to see all of the Western states, the 11 Western states.
In your Chevrolet?
Yes. My Chevrolet, yes.
So, he did find some business, or started a business in LeGrand, didn't he?
Well, after doing this for several years, he realized that this wasn't what he was going to do.
Travel around with Sigma Nu chapters.
Yes, that's right.
Yes.
So, his father had started an insurance business. He didn't have an office. He just sold life insurance. And it was more a personal contact type of thing. And so David said to his dad, let's get an office downtown and really develop an insurance business. And so we did.
Were there other insurance businesses in LeGrand at that time?
Oh, yes. There was Reynolds. There was Wilkins. And they were good-sized operators, too.
What made David think there was room for another one?
He thought that the economy was such that they could use another insurance agent. And, of course, it's the hard-working guy that gets the business.
If you can remember, what were some of the signs that the economy in LeGrand was thriving in that period?
Well, for one thing, there were downtown stores that were doing very well, very prosperous. U.S. Bank was on the corner there, and they and the First National Bank were doing well, and Trotter's Men's Store was exceptionally lucrative for the Keffers and his partner, John Group. And then there was the optometrist downtown there, Jack Pear, and his son, and they had a jewelry store and an optometrist department there, and they were doing well. And I used to see Mr. Pear, the older man, sitting out front of the store in his chair. And you don't see that sight now.
No.
Where the proprietor sits out front in the store.
Uh-huh.
And the
where was that store, do you remember?
Yes, it was right there where Carol Lee's, Jack.
I've heard several people refer to Jack Pear as the watchmaker for the railroad watches.
Uh-huh.
He was the one who checked the time.
Yes.
To make sure that they were within 15 seconds of Greenwich Mean Time or uh-huh. some central source.
Uh-huh. He was one of those marvelous characters that everybody knew who he was. And he just was welcomed aboard anywhere, any place.
Was he outgoing?
Yes, he was.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. A great personality.
Apparently, from what you say, he combined watchmaking with providing eyewear.
Yes, and he was an optometrist.
Optometrist, uh-huh. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I think he and his son did well there together and supported their families.
How was the Sacagawea Hotel doing and the Foley Hotel?
Well, this now was... it had, as I recall, the Chamber of Commerce and things moved into the lower level, and they had a wonderful coffee shop.
Of the Sacagawea?
Sacagawea, uh-huh. And they seemed to be doing all right. They hadn't started all the motels in town yet.
Right.
So they had a corner uh-huh. on the business.
Uh-huh.
And...
did you go into the Sacagawea for various other events?
A lot. We went there for dances. For meetings, there were the large meetings that were held in town. There would be a convention. They were at the SAC. And the National Guard used that for their banquets and things when they would have the dignitaries come into town. And they had wonderful service and a nice room upstairs there on the second floor. In fact, there were quite a few rooms up there on the second
floor. Ballrooms, you mean? Or meeting rooms?
Meeting
or,
rooms.
Or both.
Uh-huh. And both gathering rooms. Uh-huh.
Did and you go to banquets there?
Yes, we did. A lot of them. And went to parties there. Lots of the New Year's Eve parties were held there. And a lovely place to dance. And any time there was a big... dance given in town, it was at the SAC, and the decorations were lovely. It was a nice time.
Would you call it a first-rate hotel by standards of the 40s?
Well, back then, yes, I think
you had stayed in a lot of other hotels on these trips around Sigma News, hadn't you?
Yes, we had.
So how would you compare them with hotels in some of these other cities you've gone to?
Well,
larger ones probably than
at that time the motels were coming into existence, and in our travels in the South, We stayed at motels. It was only in Portland that we stayed at hotels.
I see.
And
was the Sacagawea as good as several of the Portland hotels, the better of Portland hotels?
Well, it had its own charm, and it was all by itself. Well, the Foley station, the Foley Hotel was in operation too. That's
yes.
Right. I forgot about that. And
it was somewhat seedier.
It was somewhat what?
Seedier.
Edier.
Seedier. We sometimes speak of seedy hotels.
Oh.
They're sort of, their maintenance is not too good, and they're just a little dingy everywhere.
I can remember coming over to Le Grand in 1934, and my brother was running in a track meet, and it was the state, it was the Eastern Oregon track meet, and we had dinner at the Foley Hotel with lovely white tablecloths and all the accompaniments, and it was busy. This hotel was lots of people were there.
That must have been during its peak years.
It probably was. And I'm glad that we were there at that time and had that experience. And of course we walked out the door and looked to our right, and instead of what you would have seen, the old Safeway store, you saw that other hotel.
The Le Grand Hotel.
Yes, the Le Grand Hotel.
Was it in operation in the 30s?
It was, yes. But I didn't go in it or buy it other than just seeing it up there. But the one thing that I did notice back when we came back from, Dave came back from Germany, and I came back from California, were the number of drug stores in town. Moon's Drug was on the corner, and it was across the street from Christensen's meat market grocery store, and then, of course, Sacagawea Hotel was on the other corner. And then there was Leishman's Drugstore. And then up the street was the Wright's Drugstore. Mr. and Mrs. Wright ran a family business, and they had a counter. And we used to go in there for some of her very good sodas.
Yes.
And then across the street was Glass Drug, and at that time it was run by Snap McManus and June McManus, and they had a partner. I don't recall his name, but I do remember he lived at the Elks Club, and rented a room at the Elks Club. And so the drugstores were doing very well then.
Why do you think that Le Grand could support so many drugstores?
Because we didn't have them all.
Well,
and then
yes, but
eating
the population of the Le Grand was about 10,000 in that period, wasn't it?
I think so.
What was there about the drugstores that maybe attracted people beyond just buying medicines?
Well, there were gift shops, and they were pretty. As I say, they didn't have to contend with a mall or the big stores are going in out on the strip.
Did they all have soda fountains?
Yes, except Glass Drug didn't have a soda fountain. And oh, the Reuters had a on the corner where Highway 30 is located, the restaurant. The Reuters had a drugstore then, and that was called Red Cross.
Oh, yes. I wondered if these were as much socializing places as drugstores.
Well, the Reuters wasn't a socializing place. It didn't have the soda fountain. It was just Moon's Drug and Leishman's Drug, was purchased by Powell Graham, and he kept the soda fountain there for quite a long while. And he bought it, I think he bought it in the late 40s. And then Wright's Drug had a soda fountain.
So when one walked down Adams Avenue and saw all these stores, and I guess a lot of people walking and cars parked, it had, Le Grand gave the impression of being thriving economically.
Yes. And then, of course, the traffic went through here. There was no superhighway.
Right.
And we got lots of people traveling through, would stop. And that was very helpful.
David and his father then were probably quite smart in thinking that another insurance agency could work, do well here.
Well, they turned out to be the biggest insurance agency in Eastern Oregon.
Were you involved in the business in some ways?
I started out as the lonely secretary. Yes. And until my twins were born. Let's see, now wait a minute. No, the twins were born and then we had the business. I had a nice babysitter for the twins and while I was secretary. And then I worked for about 6 years and then Ray was born, Ray Baum. And somehow or other we had... I just found three children in the household, about all I could handle. Plus, we were doing quite a bit of entertaining at that point, as David was moving up in the Guard, and he was head of the National Guard here in town. It just there were when they came to town to see the army, they brought their wives with them. So I started doing a lot of entertaining, mm-hmm. keeping these wives happy.
Tell me fairly briefly, if you could, why the National Guard had a site here and what they did.
Well, David served in the legislature for 6 years, and during the time that he was in the legislature, he got the first armory here. He felt it was would be a boon to the community and be a boon to Eastern Oregon, and to get the first National Guard armory here, mm-hmm. instead of in Pendleton or Baker was good for the community. And
there had to be some sort of military reason as well, wasn't there?
Well, the Guard came back from serving in the Pacific unit under Bob Carey, Sr. He came back at the end of the war, and he didn't want to head up the Guard any longer. He got out, mm-hmm. and so David took it over at that point.
Mm-hmm. But if there had been a National Guard here already, where did they have their headquarters?
Up over. Payless Drugstore, which is right in the center mm-hmm. of the Grand, mm-hmm. and right next door was F&W Woolworths, right in there, and then First National Bank was on the corner, mm-hmm. and then over, I believe it was Payless Drugstore, was their drill hall, and that's where they met and drilled.
It's a Masonic Lodge now, isn't it?
No, that's down another block.
Oh.
That's down over, well, you know where Good Things is?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a stairway that goes
oh, yes.
right up there,
right.
And that's where the Masonic Lodge
okay,
is.
Okay, then, is the place where, the block where the Guard had their drill hall, mm-hmm. is that presently on the second floor? Apartments or
no.
offices?
No.
Or is the building gone?
It's gone completely. Yeah. And of course, Pioneer Federal came in, and then there's their drive-in alley, and then there's those offices there.
Mm-hmm.
And this was right in there, right overhead.
I see.
And then the corner. I don't remember what was on the corner there where Top Shop was in, and now they're doing that building over,
mm-hmm.
and I haven't heard yet what's going in there.
No. Return for a moment to the nature of the business activity. I don't mean in general in LeGrand at the time, but at the time you were working in the insurance office as a secretary. You had a typewriter, I suppose. And
mm-hmm.
did you take shorthand for mm-hmm. letters?
Yes, I could take shorthand.
What were some of the other conditions of being a business person at that period?
Well, I think, for one thing, I had graduated from Oregon State in business.
Mm-hmm.
And And David was a very brilliant man. He was very visionary, and he was very smart. And he could figure out something so fast, and he just got right in and figured out that insurance business and worked with the companies that came in. They were, at that time, they were looking for a good agent. And he got lots of help from them. He got, and he grew fast and got acquainted with the business fast. And his father had been selling life insurance at that point. And so he came in and he continued his life insurance. And he had a few fire coverages, coverage on the homes. And so they started out, I think they had about 30 accounts when they started out. And
did David extend to crop insurance? Other
yes.
Other kinds of farm coverage?
Yes. Oh, yes. That, a lot of that. And he had many farms covered. And he had coverage over as far as Pendleton. His reputation had grown, and he knew how to insure. He became very acquainted with what their need was. Mm-hmm. And the same with the businesses in town. He knew what they needed. Mm-hmm. And if they needed an inventory policy, he knew how it worked. Mm-hmm. And that is the problem with some of these outfits that don't survive today, like Sarah Bonenkamp's beautiful, beautiful building that she had developed, a magnificent store in. She had no coverage on her
inventory.
Uh huh. Mm-hmm. Yes, she had no coverage on her inventory, and she should have had a policy where what came in was immediately reported on, and what went out was reported, mm-hmm. and she just didn't have that, mm-hmm. and that was very devastating.
Yeah.
And he certainly knew what was needed all the way around.
Day to day, when you were working in the office, you must have had some impressions of the feelings or the attitudes that that business people had toward one another. Was it highly competitive? Was it very easygoing, informal? Was it what was the tenor of business relationships?
I think they tried to be polite to each other, and but very definitely it was very competitive. And I can remember Windy Bill Wilkins. He was a fun guy, you know. You couldn't and Windy was out there for the business just like everybody else was, but Windy was a Santa Claus, the town Santa Claus, and so I'm sure he had a lot of business just through his joviality and his activities, and they were a popular family, the Wilkinses were. And then Charlie Reynolds and his two boys, Everett and Charlie Jr., had a good business, very good business, and you could feel the competition there. It wouldn't be normal. Look probably at the competition in stores here, like say D&B, and they have to contend with Bi-Mart, and they have to contend with I think the Bronson store and other stores.
Sure.
The competition just rises, and it makes you very competitive.
Mm-hmm.
And once in a while, you don't like something that's happened to you.
Yeah.
Particularly when somebody seals an account.
Yes. How did the business people at that time dress every day?
Dress?
For work.
Uh-huh. They dressed very nicely. You never went into a law office and saw the girls in jeans, or in the summertime in shorts. And you go into these law offices now, and the casualness of the women in these law offices. The casualness is absolutely amazing to me that it could...
Was it an unwritten rule that everyone needed to dress formally?
I think so. I dressed up when I went to work. I never wore slacks. I mean, I never wore jeans. I always dressed well. And all the officers, they dressed well. But you don't see that now.
No. The men wore suits and ties,
uh-huh.
White shirts.
Uh-huh. Looked very nice. David's father was groomed to the... He was well groomed.
Uh-huh.
And he smelled good. He was a darling man.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
I don't think there was probably anything unique in LeGrand about that greater formality of dress for business purposes, but did you have any sense of why people thought it was either necessary or very desirable?
I think the idea that you dress for success was very strong then. And the man that had on the suit was the man that you wanted to do business with. He was successful because he was well-dressed. And, of course, now you go into a bank, you don't see any men in the bank any longer. But I think the last man I saw in the bank there at the U.S. National was always in a suit. And I haven't been out to the other banks to check to see how they're dressed and how the women dress. I don't know.
Do you think that the mode of dress of business people and professional people in LeGrand contributed to perhaps a stronger sense then than now of a class division? A sort of upper class for the business and the professional, and a lower class for the laborers who didn't dress in that way?
It very well could have. I never thought about that. I do know that the laboring man has always been a very definite part of LeGrand and to his success. And many laboring men contribute marvelously to the community and also to their churches. And at that time we had a lot of the... I know one engineer was always in our office. We had his business, and he loved to come in and visit.
A railroad engineer, you mean, not a civil or a mechanical engineer?
No, a railroad engineer.
Yes.
And he was always dressed like he just climbed off the engine, you know. And he was so much fun to have come in. And we'd heard a lot of stories about his work. His name was Mr. Steffen. His wife is still alive, and she's 109.
Uh-huh.
And he visited us every time he came in town. He was in the office. And but he was never dressed up, believe me. But we certainly enjoyed him. Yeah. I don't know. I have friends. I never stop to think about what class they are. At the hospital where I serve as a volunteer, everybody in town works here at the hospital. What I mean is all levels of economic,
sure.
Economic levels. And the same with the volunteers, all economic levels.
When you look at some of the houses on 1st and 2nd Street and the Stang House and so on, these are obviously houses built to impress, to make other people think, oh my, those are important people who live in those places.
Yeah.
And I would have thought that perhaps that sort of thing, along with the mode of dress and perhaps several other customs, would have made class divisions more obvious in the grand.
Well, the thing that I can tell you there is after we left our little duplex on Main Street, the twins had come to town, and the landlord did not want children. So he asked us to move, and we moved down on 10th Street in a little ramshackle home. that was a temporary thing for us. We couldn't find anything else. And Delisle wanted us out of his duplex. And naturally, you aspire to do better. And after we rented there for about a year, we were able to buy a house down on 14th and Washington. And these were all laboring people down there. And we were laboring too, right along with them. And we were all trying to get along and trying to improve and trying to do better. And you kept a house long enough at that time so that when you sold it, you could take your nice extra money and buy a better house. And that's the way it went. We kept buying a better house, selling and buying a better house. You want to do better. You want to do better for your children's sake.
Yeah.
You want to do better so you can send them to college.
Mm-hmm. The Stang house must have been the climax of that for you.
Well, I didn't want the Stang house, I'll tell you very frankly. It was more than I felt I could handle. And but David was moving up in the Guard, and he was becoming well-known in the state, and he wanted the house, and he wanted it so that he would have people, when they came to town, have a good experience in Le Grand, and realize that we were a force to be reckoned with out here.
Yes.
And
was he perhaps aspiring to a higher political office?
Yes, but he didn't have the personality for it. He was quite controversial, and he created quite a bit of anti-Dave bomb, but he also had some tremendous followers who would work with him to the end of their life. They believed in what he was doing.
What led him to run for the legislature?
To further his life, to for prominence, for what he could do for the county, what he could do for the city. And as I told you, he got the armory here, and he knew how to operate.
He must have.
Uh-huh, he did. And he knew why, and he knew what his goals were.
He was in the House, not the Senate, is that right?
That's right.
For how many years?
Six.
And that was four terms, three terms?
49, 51, and 53.
Three terms.
Uh-huh. And then he ran for the fourth term, but that was at the time when Eisenhower midterm was very unpopular. His agriculture program was wrong, everything was wrong, and the Republicans went down the drain. And Lee Reynolds, one of the most popular men in town, who was the assessor, he lost. And nobody ever thought Lee Reynolds would lose. He was one of those wonderful men that was headed up the Boy Scouts and took good care of everybody and was so popular. And we were stunned to think that he lost too. I wasn't stunned to think that David lost, because he was just a sitting pigeon for that.
Do you recall what other efforts he made on behalf of Le Grand or Union County while he was in the legislature, besides the armory?
Let's see, what I wish that I could... you know, right now I can't come up with anything.
Did he speak of people in the legislature as tending to favor the west side more than the east side?
Well, that was a known
That's
fact.
That's been a long-standing division.
Yes, uh-huh. And from time to time, that swung. And everybody knew who David Baum was there in the legislature. And they also knew his connection with the Guard. And they knew that he was on the rise. They knew he'd been president of the student body at Oregon State University. And a very popular student. And... I think that, what were you asking there?
If you remembered any other efforts he made specifically on behalf of Union County.
Well, maybe not at that time, but I certainly do recall later things.
All right, let's talk about those.
Well, for one thing, he got the industrial development park out here.
It's called the Baum Industrial Park.
That's
it?
Right. Uh-huh.
Out there toward the Fleetwood Trailer and the Boise Cascade Plant.
Right.
Yes.
And he got that set apart. He got the farmers to sell him the land so that they could get in all these industries that they needed. Mm-hmm. And he felt that we were losing all our youth. That everybody was leaving, and they still do, of course. Mm-hmm. But he went to Los Angeles to talk to the Terry Trailer people. And he got them interested. And Borden Chemical, and even Boise Cascade, Duke, their particle board plant over there.
And largely as a result of his efforts.
You bet. Yeah. Well, and then he knew who to help get to help him, too. He didn't deny the fact that he had a lot of good help. He knew that there was one farmer that they needed the land from that he couldn't approach. He recognized the fact when there was not a love for Dave Bump. And he would send somebody like good-natured Bill Thomas to do the job. Bill Thomas was a realtor and he was a very popular man in the community. And Bill would go out and talk to this one farmer in particular. But David couldn't have talked to him. And he knew he couldn't have. But he was smart enough to know it, too. And so he... He got that land all set aside and got that...
Did he help to raise capital to buy the land?
Industrial development was his baby. He started the industrial development committee.
Where did the money come from to buy the land?
It was loaned to them by various men.
I see.
Uh-huh. That's what I remember.
Was there some sort of official organization that he started?
Well, it was the Industrial Development Corporation.
I see.
Uh-huh.
It was a corporation.
Yes.
Does that still exist?
There was. Well, I think it's taken over by the state, isn't it now?
I don't know.
I think so. I think the state has moved in on these various things.
There is an economic development group in LeGrand, but I don't know if it has any connection to what he might have started.
Well, I'm not sure about that either. Don't know the answer to that. Sometimes, as you're raising a family,
yes,
you don't pay enough attention.
Yes. Or ask enough questions.
That's true. And you concentrate on your kids and their welfare and keeping them through the hard times of life for them.